There is, then, a certain secret doctrine among those who revere Anubis. And in ancient times, the dog received the highest honors in Egypt. But when Cambyses killed Apis and threw the body away, and no creature approached or tasted it except the dog alone, it lost its place as first and most honored among the other animals. There are also some who call Typhon the shadow of the earth, into which they believe the moon slips and is eclipsed. Hence it would not be amiss to say that no one of them individually is right, but that altogether they are right. For it is not drought, nor wind, nor sea, nor darkness, but everything harmful and destructive that nature contains, that is a portion of Typhon. For neither should the first principles of the universe be located in lifeless bodies, as Democritus and Epicurus hold, nor should a single reason and a single providence, prevailing over and mastering all things, be posited as the maker of formless matter, as the Stoics hold. For it is impossible that anything, whether base, where God is the cause of all, or good, where he is the cause of nothing, should come into being. The harmony of the world, says Heraclitus, bends back on itself like that of the bow and the lyre. And according to Euripides, good and evil cannot exist apart, but there is a certain blending that makes things right. That is why this most ancient opinion, descending from theologians and lawgivers to poets and philosophers, has its origin untraceable, yet its conviction is strong and hard to erase, current not only in words and rumors, but also in rites and sacrifices among both barbarians and Greeks in many places. That the universe is not born along automatically, without mind or reason or guide, nor is there a single reason that rules and steers it as with a rudder or obedient reins, but rather many things, mingled from both good and evil. Or rather, speaking simply, nature here bears nothing unmixed, and it is not as though one steward, like one who apportions wares from two casks in a tavern, mixes and dispenses things to us. Rather, from two opposing principles and two rival powers, one leading toward the right and along a straight path, the other turning back and bending in the reverse direction, both life and the world, if not the whole world, at least this one around the earth and beneath the moon, have become uneven and varied and undergo every kind of change. For if nothing comes to be without a cause, and the good could not supply a cause for evil, then, just like good, evil must have its own origin and principle in nature. And this is the view of most people, and of the wisest. For some believe there are two gods, as it were rival craftsmen, one the maker of good things, the other of bad, while others call the better one god and the other a demon, as does Zoroaster the Magus, whom they record as having lived 5,000 years before the Trojan War. He called the one Orimazes and the other Arimanius, and declared further that the one most resembles light among perceptible things, the other, conversely, darkness and ignorance, while Mithras is between the two. Hence the Persians call Mithras the mediator. He taught that offerings of prayer and thanksgiving should be made to the one, and offerings of aversion and gloom to the other. For pounding a cert plant called moly in a mortar, they invoke Hades and darkness. Then, mixing it with the blood of a slaughtered wolf, they carry it out to a sunless place and cast it away. For they also believe that some plants belong to the good god, others to the evil demon, and likewise among animals, dogs and birds and land hedgehogs belong to the good, while water rats belong to the bad. Hence they consider whoever kills the most of these to be fortunate. But indeed those people too tell many mythical things about the gods, of which these are examples. Orimazes, born from the purest light, and Arimanius, born from darkness, wage war on one another. And the one made six gods, the first of goodwill, the second of truth, the third of good order, and of the rest, one of wisdom, one of wealth, and one the maker of pleasure in noble things. The other made an equal number as their rivals in each craft. Then Orimazes enlarged himself threefold, and removed himself from the sun by as great a distance as the sun is removed from the earth, and adorned the heavens with stars. And he set one star before all the others as a guardian and watchman, the dog star. He made 24 other gods and placed them in an egg. But those from Arimanius, being equal in number, pierced through the egg, whence evil has been mixed together with good ever since. And a fated time is coming, in which Arimanius, bringing on plague and famine, must by their agency be utterly destroyed and vanish. And when the earth has become flat and level, there will be one life and one government for all mankind, blessed and speaking a single tongue. Theopompus says that according to the Magi in alternation, for 3,000 years, one of the gods prevails and the other is subdued, and for another 3,000 years they fight and war and undo each other's works. But in the end, Hades will fail, and men will be happy, needing no food and casting no shadow. And the god who has contrived these things will rest and repose for a period not long, as befits a god, but moderate, as befits a sleeping man. Such then is the character of the Magi's mythology. As for the Chaldeans, they declare that of the planets whom they call the gods of birth, two are beneficent, two maleficent, and the remaining three are middling and common to both. As for the Greeks, it is plain to everyone that they assign the good portion to Olympian Zeus and the averting portion to Hades. And they tell in myth that from Aphrodite and Ares was born Harmonia, of whom the one is harsh and contentious, the other gentle and connected with birth. Consider now how the philosophers agree with these views. Heraclitus outright calls war the father and king and lord of all, and says that Homer, in praying that strife might perish from among gods and men, fails to notice that he is cursing the origin of all things, since all things arise from conflict and opposition, and that the sun will not overstep its appointed bounds, or else the Furies, handmaids of justice, will find him out. Empedocles calls the beneficent principle love and friendship, and often harmony of gentle countenance, while he calls the worst principle destructive strife and bloody discord. The Pythagoreans denote the good by many names: the one, the limited, the abiding, the straight, the odd, the square, the equal, the right, the bright, while they denote evil by the dyad, the unlimited, the moving, the curved, the even, the oblong, the unequal, the left, the dark, on the ground that such are the underlying principles of generation. Anaxagoras posits mind and the unlimited, Aristotle posits form and privation. Plato, in many places, as though veiling and concealing himself, names one of the opposing principles the same, and the other the different. But in the Laws, being now older, he speaks no longer in riddles or symbols, but in plain terms, saying that the world is moved not by one soul, but by several, perhaps, though certainly not fewer than two, of which one is beneficent, and the other opposed to it, and the maker of things opposite. He also leaves room for a certain third nature, in between, not soulless nor irrational nor unmoved of itself, as some suppose, but subordinate to both of the others, ever desiring, longing for, and pursuing the better, as the following part of the discussion will show, since he closely aligns Egyptian theology with this very philosophy. For the origin and constitution of this world is a mixture of opposing powers, not equal in strength, but with the mastery belonging to the better one. Yet it is impossible for the inferior power to be utterly destroyed, since much of it is inborn in the body, and much in the soul of the universe, ever contending fiercely against the better. Now in the soul, mind, and reason, the guide and lord of all that is best is Osiris. And in earth and wind and water and heaven and stars, that which is ordered and established and healthy, appearing through the seasons and blendings and cycles, is an outflow and image of Osiris. But Typhon is the passionate, titanic, irrational, and impulsive element in the soul. And in the bodily element, that which is perishable, diseased, and disturbing through untimely conditions and bad mixtures, and through the concealments of the sun and the disappearances of the moon, like the outbreaks and disappearances of Typhon. And the very name Seth, by which they call Typhon, points to this, for it means that which overpowers and does violence, and it also signifies frequent reversal and again a leaping over bounds. Some say that Biban was one of Typhon's companions, but Manetho says that Typhon himself was also called Biban. The name signifies restraint or hindrance, as though the power of Typhon opposed things that proceed along their course and move toward their proper end. Hence, among tame animals they assign to him the most stupid, the ass, and among wild ones the most beastly, the crocodile and the river horse. Now we have already spoken of the ass. In the city of Hermes they show an image of Typhon as a river horse, upon which stands a hawk fighting with a serpent, indicating Typhon by the horse, and by the hawk his power and rule, which Typhon, seizing by force, often does not relinquish, being disturbed by his own vice and disturbing others. That is why, when they sacrifice on the seventh day of the month Tibi, which they call the arrival of Isis from Phoenicia, they stamp upon the cakes the image of a bound river horse. And in the city of Apollo, it is customary for everyone without exception to eat crocodile. And on one day they hunt as many as they can, and, having killed them, cast them down opposite the temple, saying that Typhon fled from Horus by becoming a crocodile, thereby making all animals and plants, and evil and harmful states into the works, parts, and movements of Typhon. Osiris, on the other hand, they represent by an eye and a scepter, of which the one signifies providence, the other power, just as Homer, calling the ruler and king of all things, Zeus most high and counselor, seems by most high to signify his power, and by counselor his good judgment and wisdom. They also often depict this god as a hawk, for the hawk excels in keenness of sight and swiftness of flight, and is naturally able to sustain itself on very little food. It is said, moreover, that flying over the bodies of the unburied dead, it casts earth upon them, and when it goes to drink, on the river it raises its wing upright, and when it has drunk it lowers it again, a sign that it is safe and has escaped the crocodile, but if it is caught, its wing remains fixed as it stood. Everywhere they also display an image of Osiris in human form, with the phallus erect, because of his generative and nourishing power. And they clothe his statues in a flame-colored robe, holding that the sun is the body of the power of the good, as the visible image of an intelligible essence. For this reason, it is right to despise those who assign the sun's orb to Typhon, to whom nothing bright or life-preserving belongs, nor order, nor generation, nor motion that has measure and reason, but rather the opposites of these. And drought, which destroys many living things and growing plants, should not be reckoned the work of the sun, but of the winds and waters on earth and in the air not blended in due season, whenever the disordered and indeterminate power gains ill-timed ascendancy and quenches the exhalations. In the sacred hymns of Osiris, they invoke him as the one hidden in the arms of the sun. And on the 30th of the month Epiphi, they celebrate the birthday of the eyes of Horus, when the moon and the sun come to be on one straight line, since they hold not only the moon, but also the sun to be the eye and light of Horus. On the 8th day of the waning of Phaethon, after the autumnal equinox, they celebrate the birthday of the staff of the sun, signifying that it then needs, as it were, a support and a strengthening, since it is becoming deficient in heat and in light, sinking and moving obliquely away from us. Further, at the winter solstice, they carry the cow around the temple 7 times, and this circuit is called the seeking of Osiris, the goddess longing in winter for the water of the sun. And they go round that many times because the sun completes its passage from the winter solstice to the summer solstice in the 7th month. It is said that Horus, son of Isis, was the very first of all to sacrifice to the sun, on the 4th day of the waxing month, as is written in the books entitled The Birthdays of Horus. Moreover, every day they burn incense to the sun 3 times, resin at sunrise, myrrh at midday, and what is called kyphi around sunset. The reasoning behind each of these I shall explain later. They believe that by all these offerings they are propitiating and serving the sun. But why should I gather many such instances? For there are those who say outright that Osiris is the sun and is called Sirius by the Greeks, even though among the Egyptians the prefixed article has made the name ambiguous, and they declare Isis to be none other than the moon, whence some of her statues have horns, in imitation of the crescent, while the black-robed ones represent her concealments and eclipses, in which, in longing, she pursues the sun. For this reason, 2 people invoke the moon in matters of love, and Eudoxus says that Isis presides over love affairs. Now these views have some measure of plausibility, but those who make the sun Typhon are not even worth listening to. Let us instead return to our own proper account. Isis is the female principle of nature and receptive of every kind of generation, in accordance with which she is called by Plato the nurse and the all-receiving, while by most people she has been given countless names, because, being transformed by reason, she takes on all shapes and forms. She has an innate love for the first and most sovereign of all things, which is identical with the good, and that she desires and pursues. But the portion that comes from evil she flees and repels, being herself the region and matter for both, yet inclining always of her own accord toward the better and offering herself to it to beget and to sow into herself effluxes and likenesses, in which she rejoices and delights, becoming pregnant and filled with generative processes. For becoming is an image of being set in matter, and that which comes to be is an imitation of that which is. Hence it is not without reason that they tell the myth that the soul of Osiris is eternal and imperishable, but that his body Typhon often tears apart and makes to disappear, while Isis wanders about seeking it and fitting it together again. For that which truly is and is intelligible and good is superior to destruction and change. But the images which the sensible and corporeal world stamps from it, and the accounts, forms, and likenesses it takes on, are like seal impressions in wax that do not always remain, but are overtaken by the disorder and turbulence that here, in this world driven far from the region above, contends against Horus, whom Isis, as the image of the intelligible world made sensible, brings to birth. For this reason it is said that he is prosecuted by Typhon on a charge of illegitimacy, as not being pure and unmixed like his father, reason itself by itself unmingled and unaffected, but rather adulterated by matter because of its corporeal nature. Yet he prevails and is victorious, with Hermes, that is, reason bearing witness and showing that nature, being transformed toward the intelligible, renders the world complete. For while the gods were still in the womb of Rhea, the birth of Apollo that came from Isis and Osiris hints darkly that, before this world became manifest and matter was brought to completion by reason, nature, tested on its own, produced its first offspring imperfect. For this reason they say that that god was born maimed in the darkness, and they call him the elder Horus, for there was as yet no ordered world, but only a kind of image and phantasm of the world to come. But this later Horus is himself defined and perfect, not having utterly destroyed Typhon, but having stripped away his active and forceful power. Whence at Coptis, they say the statue of Horus holds in one hand the genitals of Typhon. And they tell the myth that Hermes, having removed the sinews of Typhon, used them as harp strings, teaching thereby that reason, having fitted the universe together, made a harmony out of unharmonious parts, and did not destroy the destructive power, but only disabled it. Hence it is weak and powerless there. But here it is mingled and entangled with the passable and changeable parts, producer of earthquakes and tremors in the earth, of droughts in the air and of unnatural winds, and again of thunderbolts and lightning. It also poisons waters and winds with pestilences, and it rises even as far as the moon and turns it back, confusing and often darkening its brightness, as the Egyptians believe and say that Typhon at one time strikes the eye of Horus, at another tears it out and swallows it and then gives it back again to the sun. By the blow they hint at the monthly waning of the moon, and by the mutilation, its eclipse, which the sun heals by shining forth again as soon as the moon escapes the shadow of the earth. The higher and more divine nature is composed of three things, the intelligible matter, and that which comes from these two, which the Greeks call the world. Now Plato is accustomed to call the intelligible the form and the pattern and the father, matter the mother and the nurse and the seat and place of generation, and that which comes from both the offspring and the generated thing. One might conjecture that the Egyptians liken the nature of the universe especially to the most beautiful of triangles, as indeed Plato too seems in the Republic to have made use of that same figure in constructing his nuptial diagram. That triangle has a vertical side of 3 units, a base of 4, and a hypotenuse of 5, equal in square to the sides containing it. We must therefore liken the vertical side to the male, the base to the female, and the hypotenuse to the offspring of both. And Osiris is to be likened to the origin, Isis to the receptacle, and Horus to the result. For 3 is the first perfect odd number, 4 is a square from the side of the even number 2, and 5 in some respects resembles the father, in others the mother, being composed of 3 and 2. And people derive from 5 their word for all, and say to 5 for to count. 5 multiplied by itself produces a number equal to the number of letters among the Egyptians and to the number of years that Apis lived. Horus they are accustomed to call also Min, which means the visible, for the world is a thing of sense and sight. Isis is sometimes called also Muth, and again Athiri and Methir. By the first of these names they signify mother, by the second, the orderly house of Horus, as Plato too calls it the region and receptacle of generation. The third is a compound of fullness and cuz, for the matter of the world is full and is joined with the good and the pure and the ordered. One might suppose that Hesiod too, in making chaos and earth and Tartarus and Eros the first of all things, takes no other principles than these. If indeed, transposing the name somewhat, we assign to Isis the part of earth, to Osiris that of Eros, and to Typhon that of Tartarus. For chaos seems to posit a kind of region or place for the universe. This myth also somehow invites comparison with the myth Plato tells, which Socrates in the Symposium relates concerning the birth of Eros. How Paeania, in want of children, lay down beside Poros as he slept, and having conceived by him, bore Eros, who is by nature mixed and manifold, since he was begotten of a father who is good and wise and self-sufficient in all things, but of a mother who is helpless and resourceless, and through want, always craving something else and clinging to something else. For Poros is none other than the first object of desire and longing, the perfect and self-sufficient, and by Paeania he meant matter, which of itself lacks the good but is filled by it, and forever longs for it and partakes of it. And the world that comes to be from these and Horus is neither eternal nor unaffected nor imperishable, but being ever generated, contrives, through the changes and cycles of its affections, to remain forever young and never to be destroyed. We must use the myths not as accounts that are wholly rational in themselves, but taking from each what is fitting according to its likeness to the truth. When we speak of matter, then, we must not, in line with the opinions of some philosophers, think of it as a soulless body without quality, inert and inactive of itself. For we call oil the matter of perfume, and gold the matter of a statue, though these are not devoid of all quality. And we ourselves make the very soul and mind of man to be, as it were, the matter of knowledge and virtue, which reason adorns and orders. And some have declared the mind to be a place of forms, and, as it were, an impression tablet of intelligible things. And some hold that the seed of the woman is not a power or a principle, but matter and nourishment for generation. Following these views, we must think of this goddess likewise in this way, that she always shares in the first god and is united with him in love of the good and beautiful things about him, not as one opposed to him, but as we say that a lawful and just man loves justly, and a good wife, though she lives with her husband, still longs for him. So she is forever craving and clinging to him and filled with his most sovereign and purest parts. But wherever Typhon breaks in and lays hold of the outermost parts, there she is said to grow downcast and to mourn, and to seek out and gather up certain remnants and fragments of Osiris, receiving into herself the things that perish and hiding them away, just as she brings to light again the things that come to be and sends them forth from herself. For the accounts and forms and effluxes of the God that are in heaven and among the stars remain, but those that are scattered among the passable things, earth, sea, plants, and animals, being dissolved and destroyed and buried, often shine forth again and reappear in new generations. For this reason, the myth says that Typhon dwells with Nephthys, but that Osiris consorts with her in secret. For the outermost parts of matter, which they call Nephthys and the end, are held chiefly by the destructive power. But the generative and preserving power sends into these a weak and dim seed, which is destroyed by Typhon, except insofar as Isis, taking it up, saves and nourishes and holds it together. In general, this power is the better one, as both Plato and Aristotle suggest. Of nature, the generative and preserving part moves toward itself and toward being, while the destructive and dissolving part moves away from itself and toward not being. For this reason, they call the one Isis, from her going with knowledge and being carried along, since she is a motion that is animate and intelligent, for the name is not foreign. But just as all the gods have a name common to them derived from two words, that which is seen and that which runs, so we call this goddess Isis from knowledge together with motion, and the Egyptians too call her Isis. So too Plato says that the ancients signified holiness by calling it Hoja, as though from motion, and likewise understanding and prudence, as being a movement and motion of mind that goes and is carried along, and applied the terms for comprehension and for the good in general and for virtue to things that flow and run. Just as, conversely, they abused with contrary names that which is evil, that which hinders and binds and holds fast nature and stops it from going and moving, calling it wickedness, helplessness, cowardice, distress. But the name Osiris is a composite formed from Hoshen, holy, and Hieron, sacred. For he is the common principle of the things in heaven and the things in Hades, of which the ancients were accustomed to call some sacred and others holy. The account that reveals the heavenly things and the things born aloft is called Anubis, and sometimes also Hermanubis, the one name belonging to the things above, the other to the things below. For this reason they sacrifice to him a white cock and a saffron-colored one, considering the one pure and radiant, the other mixed and variegated. One must not be surprised at the reshaping of these names into Greek forms, for countless other words, too, carried off along with those who migrated from Greece, remain in use to this day and are naturalized among foreigners, some of which those who reproach the so-called poetic vocabulary as barbarous, calling such words strange tongues, denounce. In the books called the Books of Hermes, it is recorded that concerning the sacred names, they say it is written in the books called the Books of Hermes that the power set over the revolution of the sun the Egyptians call Horus, while the Greeks call him Apollo. And the power set over the wind some call Osiris, others Serapis, and others, in Egyptian, Sothis, which signifies pregnancy or conception. For this reason, by a shift of the name, the star is called in Greek the dog, which they consider to belong especially to Isis. Now one ought not to be overly zealous about names. Nevertheless, I would concede to the Egyptians the name Serapis rather than Osiris, since the former is a foreign word and the latter Greek, though I hold both to belong to one god and one power. The Egyptian usage resembles this. They often call Isis by the name of Athena, expressing a meaning such as, I have come of myself, which signifies self-moved motion. Typhon, as has been said, is called Seth, Biban, and Smai, names meant to express a violent and obstructive restraint, opposition, or overturning. Further, they call the lodestone the bone of Horus, and iron the bone of Typhon, as Manetho records. For just as iron often behaves like something drawn along and following after the stone, and often turns away and is repelled in the opposite direction, so too the saving and good and rational motion of the universe turns back and draws near and makes gentler that hard and Typhonian element, persuading it, and then again, once raised up, turns back upon itself and sinks down into the boundless. Further, Eudoxus says that the Egyptians tell a myth about Zeus, that because his legs had grown together, he was unable to walk, and out of shame he spent his time in solitude. But Isis, by cutting apart and separating these parts of his body, gave him a gait sound afoot. This myth hints, among other things, that the mind and reason of the god, moving by itself in the invisible and unseen, advanced into generation through motion. The sistrum also signifies this, that existing things must be shaken and never cease from motion, but must, as it were, be roused and shaken out of their slumbering and withering. For they say that Typhon is turned away and driven back by the sistra, showing that when destruction binds and brings things to a stop, generation again dissolves and raises up nature through motion. Since the sistrum is round at the top, its arch encloses the four things that are shaken. For the portion of the world that comes into being and perishes is enclosed by the lunar sphere, and within it all things move and change through the four elements, fire, earth, water, and air. On the arch of the sistrum, at the very top, they carve a cat with a human face, and below, beneath the things that are shaken, they carve, on one side, the face of Isis, and on the other, that of Nephthys, hinting by these faces at generation and dissolution. For these are the changes and motions of the elements, and by the cat at the moon, on account of the variegated, night-working, and prolific nature of the creature. For it is said to bear one offspring, then two and three and four and five, and so on one by one up to seven, so that it bears 28 in all, the same number as the days of light of the moon. This, indeed, may be somewhat more fabulous, but the pupils of its eyes seem to fill and widen at the full moon, and to grow thin and dim during the moon's waning. In the human-shaped form of the cat is expressed the intelligent and rational element in the changes that occur around the moon. To sum up, it is not right to think that Osiris or Isis is water, or sun, or earth, or heaven, nor again that Typhon is fire or drought or sea, but simply whatever in these is immoderate and disordered through excess or deficiency, is to be assigned to Typhon, while the ordered, good, and beneficial we should revere and honor as a work of Isis, and as the image, likeness, and reason of Osiris, in this we would not be mistaken. And we shall also put an end to the doubt and perplexity of Eudoxus as to how it is that Demeter has no part in the care of erotic matters, but Isis does, and how Dionysus can neither cause the Nile to rise nor rule over the dead. For in a single, common account, we hold that these gods have been set over the whole portion of the good, and that whatever is beautiful and good in nature exists through them, the one supplying the first principles, the other receiving and distributing them. In this same way, we shall also undertake to deal with the popular and vulgar practices, whether people associate with these gods the seasonal changes of the surrounding atmosphere, or the birth of crops, the sowing, and the plowing, saying that Osiris is buried when the crop, sown, is hidden in the earth, and comes to life again and reappears when growth begins. Hence it is also said that Isis, perceiving that she was pregnant, fastened on an amulet on the sixth day of the month Phaethi, and that Harpocrates was born around the winter solstice, unfinished and young, among the plants that bloom and sprout early. That is why they bring him first offerings of budding lentils and celebrate the days of her lying in after the spring equinox. For hearing these things, people are content and believe them, drawing what is plausible straight from what is familiar and at hand. And there is nothing terrible in this, provided, first, that they keep the gods common to all of us and do not make them the private property of the Egyptians, and do not appropriate the Nile, which waters only their own land under these names, nor the marshes, nor the lotus, claiming these as a divine creation peculiar to themselves, thereby depriving other peoples, who have no Nile, no Buto, no Memphis, of great gods, for all peoples possess and recognize Isis, and the gods associated with her, even though some have only recently learned to call them by their Egyptian names, while knowing and honoring the power of each from the beginning. Second, and this is more important, that they take great care and are on guard lest they unwittingly, in describing winds and streams and sowings and plowings, and the changes of the earth and of the seasons, dissolve and explain away the divine, as do those who take Dionysus for wine and Hephaestus for flame. Or as Kleanthe says somewhere that Persephone is the breath that is carried through the crops and slain. There is even a poet who, speaking of reapers, says, at the time when vigorous men cut down Demeter's limbs, for such people are no different from those who take sails, ropes, and anchor to be the helmsman, or thread and weft to be the weaver, or a libation, honeyed drink, or barley gruel to be the physician. These give terrible and godless names to natures and things by attaching to them the names of gods, for it is not possible to conceive of these things themselves as gods. For such people are no different from those who take sail and rope and weft to be the weaver, and libation and honeyed drink to be opinions, attributing them to senseless, soulless things, necessarily perishing, used and needed by men. For God is not mindless, nor soulless, nor subject to man. Rather, from these very things which men use and need, we have come to regard as gods those who give them to us and provide them everlastingly and abidingly. Not different gods among different peoples, nor barbarian and Greek, nor southern and northern gods, but just as the sun and moon and heaven and earth and sea are common to all, though called by different names by different peoples, so too. Of the one reason that orders these things, and the one providence that governs them, and the subordinate powers appointed over everything, different honors and titles have arisen among different peoples according to their customs. And they use consecrated symbols, some dimmer, some clearer, guiding the understanding toward divine things, though not without danger. For some, straying entirely, have slipped into superstition, while others, fleeing superstition as though it were a marsh, have unwittingly fallen, as it were, off a cliff into atheism. For this reason, one must, above all, in approaching these matters, take reason from philosophy as a guide through the mysteries, and reflect reverently on each of the things said and done. So that, as Theodorus said of those who, when he offered his arguments with his right hand, received them with their left, some of his hearers doing so, we too may not go astray by wrongly construing what the laws have rightly ordained concerning sacrifices and festivals. That everything is to be referred back to reason can be seen even from these very practices themselves. On the 19th day of the first month, when they hold festival to Hermes, they eat honey and figs, saying as they do so, "Sweet is truth." And the amulet of Isis, which they tell in myth she wore, is interpreted to mean a true voice. Harpocrates, moreover, must not be thought of as an incomplete and infant god, nor as some kind of pulse or legume, but rather as the patron and corrector of the young, unfinished, and inarticulate reasoning about the gods that exists among men. That is why he holds his finger pressed to his mouth, a symbol of discreet silence. And in the month of Mesur, when they offer pulses, they say, "The tongue is fortune, the tongue is a spirit." Of the plants in Egypt, they say the Persea is especially sacred to the goddess, because its fruit resembles a heart and its leaf a tongue. For nothing that a human being naturally possesses is more divine than reason, especially reason concerning the gods, nor does anything have a greater bearing on happiness. That is why, to one descending here to the oracle, we enjoin, "Think holy thoughts, speak words of good omen." Yet most people act absurdly in their processions and festivals, first proclaiming reverent speech, and then saying and thinking the most irreverent things about the gods themselves. How, then, are we to make use of the gloomy, joyless, and mournful sacrifices, if it is neither right to omit what has been rightly established by custom, nor to confound and disturb people's opinions about the gods with strange suspicions? Among the Greeks, too, many similar things happen at about the same time of year as what the Egyptians do in their sacred rites. For at Athens the women fast, sitting on the ground at the Thesmophoria, and the Boeotians move the sacred chests of Achaea, calling that festival the Sorrowful, on the ground that because of the descent of Kore, Demeter is in grief. This month falls around the setting of the Pleiades, sowing time, which the Egyptians call Ather, the Athenians Paimption, and the Boeotians Damatrios. Theopompus records that the peoples of the West believe and call winter Cronus, summer Aphrodite, and spring Persephone, and that from Cronus and Aphrodite all things are born. The Phrygians, believing that the god sleeps in winter and is awake in summer, celebrate rites of Bacchic revelry for him, at one time lullings to sleep, at another awakenings. The Paphlagonians say that he is bound and shut up in winter and set free and moves about in spring. And the season itself gives rise to the suspicion that this gloom arose from the hiding away of the crops, which the ancients did not regard as gods, but as gifts of the gods, necessary and great for not living savagely and like wild beasts. For at that season they saw some crops vanishing altogether from the trees and disappearing, while others, which they themselves had sown, still weak and scanty, they buried in the earth with their own hands and covered over again, uncertain whether they would ever be brought to completion and fulfillment. And in this uncertainty, they performed many acts resembling burial and mourning. Then, just as we say that the one who buys the books of Plato is buying Plato, and that the one who performs the plays of Menander is acting Menander, so those people were not scrupulous about calling the gifts and works of the gods by the gods' own names, honoring and dignifying them out of need. But those who came later, receiving this uneducated and interpreting it ignorantly, turned back upon the gods themselves the experiences of the crops, and spoke of the appearances of necessary things and their disappearances not merely as the presence and hiding of the gods, but actually believed them to be the gods' births and deaths, and so filled themselves with absurd, unlawful, and confused opinions, even though they had the absurdity of this irrationality right before their eyes. Xenophanes of Colophon rightly demanded that the Egyptians, if they believed these to be gods, should not mourn them, and if they mourned them, should not believe them to be gods. For it is ridiculous, while mourning, at the same time to pray that the crops reappear and come to completion for them, so that they may again be consumed and again mourned. But that is not really how it is. Rather, they mourn the crops themselves, while they pray to the gods, who are the causes and givers, that they may again make new ones grow and spring up in place of those that perish. Hence it is well said among the philosophers that those who do not learn to understand names correctly misuse the things themselves as well. Just as among the Greeks those who have not learned or become accustomed to call the bronze, painted, and stone images and honors of the gods by their proper names, but instead call them the gods themselves, then dare to say things such as that Athena was stripped by Lachares, or that Dionysius shore off the golden locks of Apollo. or that Capitoline Zeus was burned and destroyed during the Civil War, without realizing that, along with the names, they are drawing in and accepting base opinions that follow upon them. This is a fault the Egyptians have fallen into no less, regarding the animals they honor. For the Greeks, at least in this matter, speak and think correctly, holding the dove to be a sacred animal of Aphrodite, the serpent of Athena, the raven of Apollo, and the dog of Artemis, as Euripides says, "You shall become a dog, the image of light-bearing Hecate." But most of the Egyptians, intending these very animals and treating them as gods, have brought their sacred rites into disrepute, not merely into laughter and mockery, though this is the least of the harm from their folly. A terrible opinion grows up in its place. It drives the weak and simple headlong into unmixed superstition, while in the sharper and bolder it collapses into godless and beastly reasoning. And it is not out of place to go through what is plausible concerning these matters. The notion that the gods, in fear of Typhon, changed themselves into these animals, hiding themselves, as it were, in the bodies of ibises, dogs, and hawks, surpasses every kind of monstrous tale and myth. And equally incredible is the notion that the souls of the dead that survive are reborn only into these creatures. Of those who wish to give some political explanation, some say that Osiris, in his great campaign, having divided his forces into many parts, which they call in Greek companies and divisions, gave to each an animal-shaped standard, and that each of these became sacred and honored to the tribe assigned to it. Others say that later kings, in order to terrify their enemies when they appeared in battle, put on gilded and silvered animal head masks. And others report that some clever and unscrupulous kings among the Egyptians having observed that they were by nature fickle and quick to change and revolt, but possessed of an invincible and hard-to-restrain power, once they combined and acted together, sowed in them an everlasting superstition as a pretext for unceasing strife. For since the animals which he had ordered different groups to honor and worship were hostile and warred with one another, and each was naturally disposed to eat a different food from the others, the people, always defending their own animals and taking it hard when they were wronged, were unknowingly drawn along and dragged into war against one another by the enmities of the animals. For only the Lycopolitans among the Egyptians still today eat sheep, since the wolf too, which they hold to be a god, does the same. While the Oxyrhynchites in our own time, when the Sinopolitans were eating the Oxyrhynchus fish, caught a dog, sacrificed it as a victim, and ate it. As a result of this, they fell into war and treated one another badly, and afterward, being punished by the Romans, were treated badly again. Since many say that the very soul of Typhon flew off into these animals, the myth would seem to hint that every irrational and beast-like nature has fallen to the portion of the evil demon, and that in propitiating and appeasing him, people attend to and serve these creatures. But whenever a great and harsh drought comes upon them, bringing excessive dryness, or deadly diseases, or other strange and unaccountable calamities, the priests lead away some of the honored animals in darkness, in silence and quiet, and at first threaten and try to frighten them. And if the trouble continues, they consecrate and slaughter them, as though this were some punishment of the demon, or else a great purification performed for the greatest of reasons. Indeed, in the city of Eileithyia they used to burn living men, as Manetho has recorded, calling them Typhonians, and, winnowing their ashes, they scattered and made them disappear. But this was done openly and at one fixed time during the dog days, whereas the consecrations of the honored animals are secret and occur at irregular times, as circumstances arise, escaping the notice of most people, except when they hold funerals for them, and, displaying some of the remains of the others who are present, throw them in together, thinking thereby to vex Typhon and cut short his pleasure. For Apis, along with a few others, is thought to be sacred to Osiris. To him they assign the greatest share of honors. And if this account is true, I think what we are seeking holds for those animals that are agreed upon and hold their honors in common, such as the ibis, the hawk, and the cynocephalus. But Apis himself is called by the same name as the goat kept at Mendes. There remains, then, the useful and the symbolic explanation, of which some animals partake of one, but many of both. The ox, the sheep, and the ichneumon, it is clear, they honored for use and benefit, as the Lemnians honor larks, because they find and destroy the eggs of locusts. And the Thessalians honor storks, because when the earth once sent up many snakes, the storks appeared and destroyed them all. Wherefore they also made a law that whoever kills a stork should go into exile. The asp, the weasel, and the beetle they honored because they discerned in them certain faint images, as it were in drops of sunlight, of the power of the gods. For many still believe and say of the weasel that it conceives through the ear and gives birth through the mouth, a likeness of the generation of reason, logos, and that the race of beetles has no female, but that all the males discharge their seed into the ball-shaped matter, which they roll along by pushing it in the direction opposite to themselves, just as the sun seems to turn the heavens the contrary way, while itself moving from west to east. The asp they liken to a star, as being ageless and employing unaided movements with ease and suppleness. Nor, indeed, has the crocodile lacked a plausible reason for the honor it has received, but is said to have become an image of God, since it alone is without a tongue. For the divine word has no need of voice, and, walking a soundless path, by justice guides all mortal things. They say that of all creatures living in water, it alone has its eyes covered by a smooth, transparent membrane that descends from the forehead, so that it sees without being seen, which is also true of the first God. And wherever the female lays her eggs on land, she thereby knows this to be the limit the Nile's flood will reach. For since they cannot lay in the water, yet are afraid to lay too far from it, they foresee the future with such precision that they make use of the river as it advances, both for laying and for warming their eggs, while keeping them dry and unwetted. They lay 60 eggs and hatch them in the same number of days, and those that live longest live that same number of years, a number which is the first unit of measure for those who study the heavens. But among the animals honored for both reasons, concerning the dog it has already been said, and the ibis, by killing the deadly kinds of reptiles, was the first to teach the usefulness of a medicinal purge, when people observed it thus flushing and cleansing itself. And the most scrupulous of the priests take their purifying water, for the rites of consecration, from a place where an ibis has drunk. For it does not drink water that is diseased or tainted, nor does it even approach such water. By the spacing of its feet from one another and its beak, it forms an equilateral triangle. And further, the mingling and variegation of its black feathers with the white displays the moon in its gibbous phase. One need not be surprised that the Egyptians cherished such slight resemblances, for the Greeks, too, in both painted and sculpted images of the gods, made use of many such things. In Crete, for instance, there was a statue of Zeus that had no ears, since it is not fitting for the ruler and lord of all to listen to anyone. Phidias placed the serpent beside his statue of Athena, and the tortoise beside his statue of Aphrodite at Eli's, signifying that maidens need guarding, while wives need to keep to the house and observe becoming silence. The trident of Poseidon is a symbol of the third region, which the sea occupies, ranked after heaven and air. Hence they also gave Amphitrite and the Tritons their names accordingly. The Pythagoreans, too, adorned numbers and figures with the names of gods. The equilateral triangle they called Athena, born from the head and Tritoshnea, because it is divided by three perpendiculars drawn from its three angles. The number one they called Apollo, by denial of plurality and because of the simplicity of the monad. The dyad they called Strife and Daring. The triad, Justice, for since wrongdoing and being wronged consist in deficiency and excess, justice has come to occupy the middle position, inequality. And the so-called Tetractes, the number 36, was the greatest oath, as has often been said, and was named the Cosmos, being made up from the first four even numbers and the first four odd numbers added together. If then the most respected philosophers, discerning a riddle of the divine even in things lifeless and bodiless, thought it right to neglect and dishonor nothing, I think it far more fitting to cherish the distinctive properties found in natures that have perception, that possess soul, feeling, and character, and to hold these dear, not honoring the creatures themselves, but through them the divine, as clearer mirrors formed by nature, regarding them always as instruments or works of the God who orders all things. And, in general, to maintain that nothing lifeless is better than something living, nor anything without perception better than something that perceives, not even if one heaped together all the gold and emerald in the world. For it is not in colors, nor in shapes, nor in smoothness that the divine comes to be, but whatever has no share, and by nature cannot share, in life has a lot more dishonorable than that of the dead. But the nature that lives and sees and has within itself the source of its own motion, and knowledge of what belongs to it and what is foreign, has drawn an outflow of beauty and a portion from that intelligence, by which the universe is steered, as Heraclitus says. Hence the divine is represented no worse in these creatures than in works of bronze and stone, which likewise suffer decay and discoloration, but by nature are deprived of all perception and understanding. Concerning the honored animals, then, these are the explanations I most approve of among those given. As for their robes, those of Isis are variegated in their dyes, since her power has to do with matter, which becomes and receives all things, light and darkness, day and night, fire and water, life and death, beginning and end. But that of Osiris has no shadow or variegation, but one single, simple color of light, for the first principle is unmixed and the primary, intelligible reality is unblended. Hence, once they have taken up this robe, they put it away and guard it, unseen and untouched. But they use the robes of Isis often, for perceptible things, being in use and close at hand, offer many unfoldings and views of themselves as they change now one way, now another. But the understanding of the intelligible, pure, and simple allows the soul only once, like a flash of lightning, to touch and glimpse it. This is why both Plato and Aristotle call this part of philosophy the epoptic part, since those who by reasoning pass beyond these opinable, mixed, and variegated things leap toward that first reality, simple and immaterial, and having simply touched the pure truth concerning it, consider that they possess philosophy's complete end. And this is what the priests of today, with reverent caution and veiled language, hint at when they suggest that this god rules and reigns over the dead, being none other than the one called Hades and Pluto among the Greeks. Since it is not understood how this is true, it disturbs most people, who suspect that the holy and truly sacred Osiris dwells in the earth and beneath the earth, where the bodies of those thought to have reached their end are hidden. But he himself is in fact very far removed from the earth, unstained, undefiled, and pure of all substance that admits of decay and death. For the souls of men here, enclosed as they are by bodies and passions, have no participation in God, except so far as they may attain, through philosophy, to a dim, dreamlike touch of him by understanding. But when they are released and pass over into the formless, invisible, passionless, and pure, then this God becomes their leader and king, since they now depend on him and gaze insatiably and long for that beauty which cannot be told or spoken by men. The beauty of which ancient tradition declares that Isis, ever loving and pursuing and consorting with him, fills this world with all things fair and good, so far as they partake of generation. These things, then, stand thus, in the account most fitting for the gods. But if I am also to speak of the incense burned each day, as I promised, one should first consider this, that men are always most earnestly concerned with practices conducive to health, and especially in their sacred rites, purifications, and ways of life, the wholesome is regarded no less than the holy. For they did not think it right to serve what is pure and wholly unharmed, and undefiled with bodies or souls that were themselves unsound and diseased. Since then, the air, which we use the most and live constantly amid, does not always keep the same condition and mixture, but at night grows dense and presses upon the body and draws the soul together into despondency and a kind of murky, anxious heaviness. They rise at once and burn resin as incense, treating and purifying the air through this separation and fanning back to life the innate breath in the body when it has grown faint, since the scent has something forceful and startling about it. Again, at midday, perceiving that the sun forcibly draws up a great, heavy exhalation from the earth and mixes it with the air, they burn myrrh as incense. For heat dissolves and disperses whatever murky, muddy matter has gathered in the surrounding air. And indeed physicians too seem to help against pestilential diseases by kindling a great fire, since it thins the air. And it thins the air better if they burn fragrant woods, such as cypress, juniper, and pine. Acheron the physician, at any rate, is said to have won renown at Athens during the Great Plague by ordering a fire to be kept burning beside the sick, for it benefited not a few. Aristotle says that the fragrant exhalations of perfumes, flowers, and meadows contribute no less to health than to pleasure, since with their warmth and smoothness they gently dissolve the brain, which is by nature cold and frosty. And if indeed the Egyptians call myrrh Baal, which when translated means chiefly the scattering away of foolish talk, this too lends the argument some support for its cause. Kaifi is a compound made of 16 ingredients combined: honey, wine, raisins, cypress grass, resin, myrrh, and aspalathus in Sicily, and further mastic, asphalt, rush, and dock, and besides these two kinds of juniper berries, of which they call one the greater and the other the lesser, and cardamom and sweet flag. These are not compounded just as it happens, but while sacred writings are read aloud to the perfume makers as they mix them. As for the number of ingredients, even though it seems altogether a square derived from a square, and is alone among numbers of equal factors multiplied by equal factors in having its perimeter equal to its area, one should say this contributes very little to the purpose. Rather, most of the ingredients that are gathered together, having aromatic properties, give off a sweet breath and a wholesome exhalation by which the air is transformed, and the body, stirred through the breathing of it, is gently and mildly lulled to sleep and acquires an inviting temper, and loosens and dissolves, without any intoxication, the painful, tight knots, as it were, of the day's cares. And it polishes, like a mirror, the imaginative part of the soul that receives dreams, and makes it clearer, no less than the strains of the lyre which the Pythagoreans used before sleep, charming away and healing the passionate and irrational part of the soul. For scents often recall a failing sense of perception, and often again dull and comet, as their particles are diffused through the body by their smoothness. Just as some physicians say that sleep comes about when the exhalation of food, creeping gently, as it were, around the internal organs and touching them, produces a kind of tickling. Kaifi is used both as a drink and as a mixture, for when drunk it seems to purge the inward parts, being a gentle laxative. Apart from these ingredients, resin is the product of the sun, and myrrh comes from the sun's heat as the plants weep it forth. Of those who compound kaifi, some prefer it made at night, like those substances that by nature are nourished by cold winds, shadows, dew, and moisture, since the light of day is one thing, simple, and the sun, as Pindar says, is seen coursing solitary through the upper air. The night air, on the other hand, is a blend and mixture of many lights and powers, as though the seeds streaming down from every star flowed together into one. It is reasonable, then, that those substances which are simple and derive their origin from the sun should be burned as incense by day, while those that are mixed and of varied qualities should be desired for burning at the coming on of night.